Principle 13.2. Systemize your principles and how they will be implemented. If you have good principles that guide you from your values to your day-to-day decisions, but you don't have a systematic way of making sure they're regularly applied, they're not of much use. It's essential to build your most important principles into habits and help others do so as well. Bridgewater's tools and culture are designed to do just that. A. Create great decision-making machines by thinking through the criteria you are using to make decisions while you are making them. Whenever I make an investment decision, I observe myself making it and think about the criteria I used. I ask myself how I would handle another one of those situations and write down my principles for doing so. Then I turn them into algorithms. I am now doing the same for management, and I've gotten in the habit of doing it for all my decisions. Algorithms are principles in action on a continuous basis. I believe that systemized, evidence-based decision-making will radically improve the quality of management. Human managers process information spontaneously using poorly thought-out criteria and are unproductively affected by their emotional biases. These all lead to suboptimal decisions. Imagine what it would be like to have a machine that processes high-quality data using high-quality decision-making principles and criteria. Like the GPS in your car, it would be invaluable, whether you follow all of its suggestions or not. I believe such tools will be essential in the future, and as I read these words, I am a short time away from getting a prototype online. Principle 13.3. Remember that a good plan should resemble a movie script. The more vividly you can visualize how the scenario you create will play out, the more likely it is to happen as you plan. Visualize who will do what when, and the result they'll produce. This is your mental map of your machine. Recognize that some people are better or worse at visualization. Accurately assess your own abilities and those of others so you can use the most capable people to create your plans. A. Put yourself in the position of pain for a while so that you gain a richer understanding of what you're designing for. Either literally or vicariously through reading reports, job descriptions, etc., temporarily insert yourself into the workflow of the area you're looking at to gain a better understanding of what it is you are dealing with. As you design, you'll be able to apply what you've learned and revise the machine appropriately as a result. B. Visualize alternative machines and their outcomes, and then choose. A good designer is able to visualize the machine and its outcomes in various iterations. First, they imagine how Harry, Larry, and Sally can operate in various ways with various tools and different incentives and penalties. Then they replace Harry with George, and so on, thinking through what the products and people and finances would look like month by month, or quarter by quarter, under each scenario. Then they choose. C. Consider second and third order consequences, not just first order ones. The outcome you get as a first order consequence might be desirable, while the second or third order consequences could be the opposite. So focusing solely on first order consequences, which people tend to do, can lead to bad decision making. For example, if you asked me if I'd like to not have rainy days, I probably would say yes if I didn't consider the second and third order consequences. D. Use standing meetings to help your organization run like a Swiss clock. Regularly scheduled meetings add to overall efficiency by ensuring that important interactions and to-dos aren't overlooked, eliminating the need for inefficient coordination and improving operations. Because repetition leads to refinement. It pays to have standardized meeting agendas that ask the same feedback questions in each meeting, such as how effective the meeting was, and non-standard meeting agendas that include things done infrequently, such as quarterly budget reviews. E. Remember that a good machine takes into account the fact that people are imperfect. Design in such a way that you produce good results, even when people make mistakes. Principle 13.4. Recognize that design is an iterative process. between a bad now and a good then is a working through it period. That working through it period is when you try out different processes and people, seeing what goes well or poorly, learning from the iterations and moving toward the ideal systematic design. Even with a good future design picture in mind, it will naturally take some mistakes and learning to get to a good then state. People frequently complain about this kind of iterative process because it tends to be true that people are happier with nothing at all than with something imperfect, even though it would be more logical to have the imperfect thing. That kind of thinking doesn't make sense, so don't let it distract you. A. Understand the power of the cleansing storm. In nature, cleansing storms are big, infrequent events that clear out all the overgrowth that's accumulated during good times. Forests need these storms to be healthy. Without them, there would be more weak trees and a buildup of overgrowth that stifles other growth. The same is true for companies. Bad times that force cutbacks so only the strongest and most essential employees or companies survive are inevitable and can be great, even though they seem terrible at the time. Principle 13.5. Build the organization around goals rather than tasks. Giving each department a clear focus and the appropriate resources to achieve its goals makes the diagnosis of resource allocations more straightforward and reduces job slip. As an example of how this works, at Bridgewater, we have a marketing department, goal to market, that is separate from our client service department, goal to service clients, even though they do similar things and there would be advantages to having them work together. But marketing and servicing clients are two distinct goals. If they were merged, the department head, salespeople, client advisors, analysts, and others would be giving and receiving conflicting feedback. If asked why clients were receiving relatively poor attention, the answer might be, we have incentives to raise sales. If asked why they weren't making sales, the merged department might explain that they need to take care of their clients. A. Build your organization from the top down. An organization is the opposite of a building. Its foundation is at the top, so make sure you hire managers before you hire their reports. Managers can help design the machine and choose the people who complement it. People overseeing departments need to be able to think strategically as well as run the day-to-day. If they don't anticipate what's coming up, they'll run the day-to-day off a cliff. B. Remember that everyone must be overseen by a believable person who has high standards. Without strong oversight, there is potential for inadequate quality control, inadequate training, and inadequate appreciation of excellent work. Never just trust people to do their jobs well. C. Make sure the people at the top of each pyramid have the skills and focus to manage their direct reports and a deep understanding of their jobs. A few years ago, someone at Bridgewater proposed that our facilities group, the people who take care of the building and grounds, food service, office supplies, etc., should begin to report to our head of technology because of the overlap in the two areas. Computers are a facility too, they use electricity and so on. But having the people who are responsible for janitorial services and meals report to a technology manager would be as inappropriate as having technology people report to the person taking care of facilities. These functions, even if they're considered facilities in the broadest sense, are very different, as are the respective skill sets. Similarly, at another time, we talked about putting the folks who work on client agreements under the same manager as those who do counterparty agreements. But that would have been a mistake, because the skills required to reach agreements with clients are very different from the skills required to reach agreements with counterparties. It would be wrong to conflate both departments under the general heading of agreements, because each calls for specific knowledge and skills. D. In designing your organization, remember that the five-step process is the path to success and that different people are good at different steps. Assign specific people to do each of these steps based on their natural inclinations. For example, the big picture visionary should be responsible for goal setting. The taste tester should be assigned the job of identifying and not tolerating problems. The logical detective who doesn't mind probing people should be the diagnoser, the imaginative designer should craft the plan to make the improvements, and the reliable taskmaster should make sure the plan gets executed. Of course, some people can do more than one of these things. Generally, people do two or three well. Virtually nobody can do them all well. A team should consist of people with all of these abilities, and they should know who is responsible for which steps. E. Don't build the organization to fit the people. Managers will often take the people who work in their organization as a given and try to make the organization work well with them. That's backward. Instead, they should imagine the best organization and then make sure the right people are chosen for it. Jobs should be created based on the work that needs to be done, not what people want to do or which people are available. You can always search outside to find the people who click best for a particular role. First, come up with the best workflow design, then sketch it out on an organizational chart, visualize how the parts interact, and specify what qualities are required for each job. Only after all that is done should you choose the people to fill the slots. F. Keep scale in mind. Your goals must be the right size to warrant the resources that you allocate to them. An organization might not be big enough to justify having both a sales and an analytics group, for example. Bridgewater successfully evolved from a one-cell organization, in which most people were involved in everything, to a multicellular organization because we retained our ability to focus efficiently as we grew. Temporarily sharing or rotating resources is fine and is not the same as a merging of responsibilities. On the other hand, the efficiency of an organization decreases as the number of people and/or its complexity increases, so keep things as simple as possible. And the larger the organization, the more important are information technology management and cross-departmental communication. G. Organize departments and sub-departments around the most logical groupings based on gravitational pull. Some groups naturally gravitate toward one another. That gravitational pull might be based on common goals, shared abilities and skills, workflow, physical location, and so forth. Imposing your own structure without acknowledging these magnetic pulls will likely result in inefficiency. H. Make departments as self-sufficient as possible so they have control over the resources they need to achieve their goals. We do this because we don't want to create a bureaucracy that forces departments to requisition resources from a pool that lacks the focus to do the job. I. Ensure that the ratios of senior managers to junior managers and of junior managers to their reports are limited to preserve quality communication and mutual understanding. Generally, the ratio should not be more than 1 to 10 and preferably closer to 1 to 5. Of course, the appropriate ratio will vary depending on how many people your direct reports have reporting to them, the complexity of the jobs they're doing, and a manager's ability to handle several people or projects at once. The number of layers from top to bottom and the ratio of managers to their direct reports will limit the size of an effective organization. J. Consider succession and training in your design. This is a subject I wish I had thought about much earlier in my career. To ensure that your organization continues to deliver results, you need to build a perpetual motion machine that can work well without you. This involves more than mechanics of your own stepping out, but the selection and training and governance of the new leaders who step up, and most importantly, the preservation of the culture and its values. The best approach I've seen for doing this is what companies and organizations like GE, 3G, and the Chinese Politburo do, which is to build a pyramid-like succession pipeline, in which the next generation of leaders is exposed to the thinking and decision-making of the current leaders so they can both learn and be tested. K. Don't just pay attention to your job. Pay attention to how well your job will be done if you are no longer around. I wrote about key man risk earlier, which applies the most to those with the largest areas of responsibility, especially the head of an organization. If that's you, then you should designate the people who would replace you and have them do your job for a while so they can be vetted and tested. These results should be documented in a manual that the appropriate people can go to if you should be hit by a bus. If all the key people in the organization do this, you will have a strong farm team, or at least a clear understanding of vulnerabilities and a plan to deal with them. Remember that a ninja manager is somebody who can sit back and watch beauty happen. That is, an orchestrator. If you are always trying to hire somebody who is as good or better than you at your job, that will both free you up to go on to other things and build your succession pipeline. Beyond that, visualizing your replacement is an enlightening and productive experience. In addition to taking stock of what you are doing and coming up with both bad and good names, you will start to think about how to get your best people into slots that don't yet exist. Knowing that you will have to test them by letting them do your job without interference, you will be motivated to train them properly before the test. And of course, the stress testing will help you learn and adapt, which will lead to better results. L. Use double do rather than double check to make sure mission-critical tasks are done correctly. Double checking has a much higher rate of errors than double doing, which is having two different people do the same task so that they produce two independent answers. This not only ensures better answers, but will allow you to see the differences in people's performance and abilities. I use double do's in critical areas such as finance, where large amounts of money are at risk. And because an audit is only as effective as the auditor is knowledgeable, remember that a good double check can only be done by someone capable of double doing. If the person double checking the work isn't capable of doing the work himself, how could he possibly evaluate it accurately? M. Use consultants wisely and watch out for consultant addiction. Sometimes hiring an external consultant is the best fit for your design. Doing so can get you precisely the amount of specialized expertise you need to tackle a problem. When you can outsource, you don't have to worry about managing, and that's a real advantage. If a position is part-time and requires highly specialized knowledge, I would prefer to have it done by consultants or outsiders. At the same time, you need to beware of the chronic use of consultants to do work that should be done by employees. This will cost you in the long run and erode your culture. Also, make sure you are careful not to ask consultants to do things that they don't normally do. They will almost certainly revert to doing things in their usual way. Their own employers will demand that. When evaluating whether to use a consultant, consider the following factors. 1. Quality control. When someone doing work for you is an employee, you are responsible for the quality of their work. But when the person working for you works for another company, you're operating by their standards, so it's important to know whether their standards are as high or higher than yours. 2. Economics. If a full-time person is required, it is almost certainly more cost-effective to create a position. Consultants' daily rates add up to considerably more than the annualized cost of a full-time person. 3. Institutionalization of knowledge. Someone who is around your environment on an ongoing basis will gain knowledge and an appreciation of your culture that no outsider can. 4. Security. Having outsiders do the job substantially increases your security risks, especially if you can't see them at work, and monitor whether they follow proper precautions, like not leaving sensitive documents on their desks. You have to consider whether you should be outsourcing or developing capabilities in-house. Though temps and consultants are good for a quick fix, they won't augment your capacities in the long term. Principle 13.6. Create an organizational chart to look like a pyramid with straight lines down that don't cross. The whole organization should look like a series of descending pyramids, but the number of layers should be limited to minimize hierarchy. A. Involve the person who is the point of the pyramid when encountering cross-departmental or cross-sub-departmental issues. Imagine an organizational chart as a pyramid that consists of numerous pyramids. When issues involve parties not in the same part of the pyramid, it is generally desirable to involve the person who is at the point of the pyramid and thus has the perspective and knowledge to weigh the trade-offs and make informed decisions. B. Don't do work for people in another department or grab people from another department to do work for you unless you speak to the person responsible for overseeing the other department. If there is a dispute about this, it needs to be resolved at the point of the pyramid. C. Watch out for department slip. This happens when a support department mistakes its responsibility to provide support with a mandate to determine how the thing they are supporting should be done. An example of this sort of mistake would be if the facilities group thought it should determine what facilities we should have. While support departments should know the goals of the people they are supporting and provide feedback regarding possible choices, they are not the ones to determine the vision. Principle 13.7. Create guardrails when needed, and remember, it's better not to guardrail at all. Even when you find people who are great clicks for your design, there will be times when you want to build guardrails around them. No one is perfect, everyone has strengths and weaknesses, and as hard as you look, you won't always be able to find everything you want in one person. So look down on your machine and the people you choose for your roles, and think about where you might need to supplement your design by adding people or processes to ensure that each job is done excellently. Remember, guardrailing is meant to help people who can by and large do their jobs well. It's intended to help good people perform better, not help failing people reach the bar. If you're trying to guardrail someone who is missing the core abilities required for their job, you should probably just fire them and look for someone else who will be a better click. A good guardrail typically takes the form of a team member whose strengths compensate for the weaknesses of the team member who needs to be guardrailed. A good guardrailing relationship should be firm without being overly rigid. Ideally, it should work like two people dancing. They're literally pushing against each other, but with a lot of mutual give and take. Of course, having someone in a job who needs to be guardrailed is not as good as having someone in a job who will naturally do the right things. Strive for that. A. Don't expect people to recognize and compensate for their own blind spots. I constantly see people form wrong opinions and make bad decisions, even though they've made the same kinds of mistakes before, and even though they know that doing so is illogical and harmful. I used to think that they would avoid these pitfalls when they became aware of their blind spots, but typically that's not the case. Only very rarely do I hear someone recuse himself from offering an opinion because they aren't capable of forming a good one in a particular area. Don't bet on people to save themselves. Proactively guardrail them, or better yet, put them in roles in which it's impossible for them to make the types of decisions they shouldn't make. B. Consider the cloverleaf design. In situations where you're unable to identify one excellent responsible party for a role, which is always best, find two or three believable people who care deeply about producing excellent results and are willing to argue with each other and escalate their disagreements if necessary. Then set up a design in which they check and balance each other. Though it's not optimal, such a system will have a high probability of effectively sorting the issues you need to examine and resolve. Principle 13.8. Keep your strategic vision the same while making appropriate tactical changes as circumstances dictate. Bridgewater's values and strategic goals have been the same since the beginning: to produce excellent results, meaningful work, and meaningful relationships through radical truth and transparency. But its people, systems, and tools have changed over 40-plus years as we have grown from a one-person company to a 1,500-person organization, and they can continue to change while maintaining values and strategic goals as newer generations replace older ones. That can happen for organizations in much the same way as it happens for families and communities. To help nurture that, it is desirable to reinforce the traditions and reasons for them, as well as to make sure the values and strategic goals are imbued in the successive leaders and the population as a whole. A. Don't put the expedient ahead of the strategic. People often tell me they can't deal with the longer-term strategic issues because they have too many pressing issues they need to solve right away. But rushing into ad hoc solutions while kicking the proverbial can down the road is a path to slaughter. Effective managers pay attention both to imminent problems and to problems that haven't hit them yet. They constantly feel the tug of the strategic path because they worry about not getting to their ultimate goal, and they are determined to continue their process of discovery until they do. While they might not have the answer right away, and they might not be able to come up with it by themselves, through a combination of creativity and character, they eventually make all the necessary upward loops. B. Think about both the big picture and the granular details and understand the connections between them. Avoid fixating on irrelevant details. You have to determine what's important and what's unimportant at each level. For example, imagine you were designing a house. First, you need to start with the big picture. Your house will sit on a plot of land, and you have to think through where the water comes from, how the house gets hooked up to the power grid, and so on. Then, you need to decide how many rooms it will have, where the doors will go, where you need windows, and so on. When designing the plan, you need to think about all of these things and connect them, but that doesn't mean that you actually need to go out and pick the hinges for the door yourself. You just need to know that you'll need a door with hinges and how it fits into the bigger picture of the house. Principle 13.9. Have good controls so that you are not exposed to the dishonesty of others. Don't assume that people are operating in your interest rather than their own. A higher percentage of the population than you might imagine will cheat if given the opportunity. When offered the choice of being fair with you or taking more for themselves, most people will take more for themselves. Even a tiny amount of cheating is intolerable, so your happiness and success will depend on your controls. I have repeatedly learned this lesson the hard way. A. Investigate and let people know you are going to investigate. Investigate and explain to people that you are going to investigate so there are no surprises. Security controls should not be taken personally by the people being checked, just like a teller shouldn't view the bank counting the money in the drawer, rather than just accepting the teller's count, as an indication that the bank thinks the teller is dishonest. Explain that concept to employees so that they understand it. But even the best controls will never be foolproof. For that reason, among many others, trustworthiness is a quality that should be appreciated. B. Remember that there is no sense in having laws unless you have policemen, auditors. The people doing the auditing should report to people outside the department being audited, and auditing procedures should not be made known to those being audited. This is one of our few exceptions to radical transparency. C. Beware of rubber stamping. When a person's role involves reviewing or auditing a high volume of transactions or things that other people are doing, there's a real risk of rubber stamping. One particularly risky example is expense approvals. Make sure you have ways to audit the auditors. D. Recognize that people who make purchases on your behalf probably will not spend your money wisely. This is because, one, it is not their money, and two, it is difficult to know what the right price should be. For example, if somebody proposes a price of $125,000 for a consulting project, it is unpleasant, difficult, and confusing to figure out what the market rate is and then negotiate a better price. But the same person who's reluctant to negotiate with the consultant will bargain furiously when he is hiring someone to paint his own house. You need to have proper controls, or better yet, a part of the organization that specializes in this kind of thing. There's retail and there's wholesale. You want to pay wholesale whenever possible. E. Use public hangings to deter bad behavior. No matter how carefully you design your controls and how rigorously you enforce them, malicious and grossly negligent people will sometimes find a way around them. So when you catch someone violating your rules and controls, make sure that everybody sees the consequences. Principle 13.10. have the clearest possible reporting lines and delineations of responsibilities. This applies both within and between departments. Dual reporting causes confusion, complicates prioritization, diminishes focus on clear goals, and muddies the lines of supervision and accountability, especially when the supervisors are in two different departments. When situations require dual reporting, managers need to be informed. Asking someone from another department to do a task without consulting with his or her manager is strictly prohibited unless the request will take less than an hour or so. However, appointing co-heads of a department or a sub-department can work well if the managers are in sync and combine complementary and essential strengths. Dual reporting in that case can work well if properly coordinated. A. Assign responsibilities based on workflow design and people's abilities, not job titles. Just because someone is responsible for human resources, recruiting, legal, programming, and so forth, doesn't necessarily mean they are the appropriate person to do everything associated with those functions. For example, though HR people help with hiring, firing, and providing benefits, it would be a mistake to give them the responsibility of determining who gets hired and fired and what benefits are provided to employees. B. Constantly think about how to produce leverage. Leverage in an organization is not unlike leverage in the markets. You're looking for ways to achieve more with less. At Bridgewater, I typically work at about 50-to-1 leverage, meaning that for every hour I spend with each person who works for me, they spend about 50 hours working to move the project along. At our sessions, we go over the vision and the deliverables, then they work on them, and then we review the work, and they move forward based on my feedback. And we do that over and over again. The people who work for me typically have similar relationships with those who work for them, though their ratios are typically between 10-to-1 and 20-to-1. I'm always eager to find people who can do things nearly as well as, and ideally better than, I can, so that I can maximize my output per hour. Technology is another great tool for providing leverage. To make training as easy to leverage as possible, document the most common questions and answers through audio, video, or written guidelines, and then assign someone to organize them and incorporate them into a manual, which is updated on a regular basis. Principles themselves are a form of leverage. They're a way to compound your understanding of situations so that you don't need to exert the same effort each time you encounter a problem. C. Recognize that it is far better to find a few smart people and give them the best technology than to have a greater number of ordinary people who are less well-equipped. Great people and great technology both enhance productivity. Put them together in a well-designed machine, and they improve it exponentially. D. Use leveragers. Leveragers are people who can go from conceptual to practical effectively, and do the most to get your concepts implemented. Conceptualizing and managing takes only about 10% of the time needed for implementing, so if you have good leveragers, you can devote a lot more of your time to what's most important to you. Principle 13.11. Remember that almost everything will take more time and cost more money than you expect. Virtually nothing goes according to plan because one doesn't plan for the things that go wrong. I personally assume things will take about 1.5 times as long and cost about 1.5 times as much because that's what I've typically experienced. How well you and the people working with you manage will determine your expectations. Chapter 14. Do what you set out to do. The organization, like the individual, has to push through to results in order to succeed. This is step 5 in the 5-step process. While recently cleaning up a huge pile of work products from the 1980s and 1990s, I came across boxes and boxes full of research. There were thousands of pages, most covered with my scribbles, and I realized that they represented just a fraction of the effort I'd put in. At our 40th year celebration, I was given copies of the almost 10,000 Bridgewater Daily Observations that we'd published. Every one of them expressed our deepest thinking and research about markets and economies. I also stumbled across the manuscript of an 800-page book that I wrote but then got too busy to publish, and countless other memos and letters to clients, research reports, and versions of the audiobook you're listening to now. Why did I do all these things? Why do others work so hard to achieve their goals? From what I can see, we do it for different reasons. For me, the main reason is that I can visualize the results of pushing through so intensely that I experience the thrill of success even while I'm still struggling to achieve it. Similarly, I can visualize the tragic results of not pushing through. I'm also motivated by a sense of responsibility. I have a hard time letting people I care about down. But that's just what's true for me. Others describe their motivation as attachment to the community and its mission. Some do it for approval, and some do it for financial rewards. All these are perfectly acceptable motivations and should be used and harmonized in a way consistent with the culture. The way one brings people together to do this is key. This is what most people call leadership. What are the most important things that a leader needs to do in order to get their organizations to push through to results? Most importantly, they must recruit individuals who are willing to do the work that success requires. While there might be more glamour in coming up with the brilliant new ideas, most of success comes from doing the mundane and often distasteful stuff, like identifying and dealing with problems and pushing hard over a long time. This was certainly the case with the client service department. Through a lot of relentless hard work in the years since the original problem turned up, the department has become an example to other teams at Bridgewater, and our client satisfaction levels remain consistently high. The great irony of all this is that none of our clients ever even noticed the problems we saw with the memos. Sending out work not up to our standards was bad, and I'm glad it was corrected. But it could have been much worse, tarnishing our reputation for delivering pervasive excellence. Once that happens, it becomes much harder to restore trust. Principle 14.1. Work for goals that you and your organization are excited about. And think about how your tasks connect to those goals. If you're focused on the goal, excited about achieving it, and recognize that doing some undesirable tasks to achieve the goal is required, you will have the right perspective and will be appropriately motivated. If you're not excited about the goal that you're working for, stop working for it. Personally, I like visualizing exciting new and beautiful things that I want to make into realities. The excitement of visualizing these ideas and my desire to build them out is what pulls me through the thorny realities of life to make my dreams happen. A. Be coordinated and consistent in motivating others. Managing groups to push through to results can be done emotionally or intellectually, and by carrots or by sticks. While we each have our own reasons for working, there are unique challenges and advantages to motivating a community. The main challenge is the need to coordinate, that is, to get in sync on the reasons for pursuing a goal and the best way to do it. For example, you wouldn't want one group to be motivated and compensated so differently from another, one gets big bonuses, for example, and another doesn't under the same set of circumstances, that the differences cause problems. The main advantage of working in groups is that it's easier to design a group to include all the qualities needed to be successful than to find all those qualities in one person. As with the steps in the five-step process, some people are great at one step and some are terrible at that step. But it doesn't matter which is the case when everyone is clear on each other's strengths and weaknesses and the group is designed to deal with those realities. B. Don't act before thinking. Take the time to come up with a game plan. The time you spend on thinking through your plan will be virtually nothing in relation to the amount of time that will be spent doing, and it will make the doing radically more effective. C. Look for creative, cut-through solutions. When people are facing thorny problems or have too much to do, they often think that they need to work harder. But if something seems hard, time-consuming, and frustrating, take some time to step back and triangulate with others on whether there might be a better way to handle it. Of course, many things that need getting done are just a slog, but it's often the case that there are better solutions out there that you're not seeing. Principle 14.2. Recognize that everyone has too much to do. How to do more than we think we can is a puzzle we all struggle with. Other than working harder for longer hours, there are three ways to fix the problem. One, having fewer things to do by prioritizing and saying no. Two, finding the right people to delegate to. And three, improving your productivity. Some people spend a lot of time and effort accomplishing very little, while others do a lot in the same amount of time. What differentiates people who can do a lot from those who can't is creativity, character, and wisdom. Those with more creativity invent ways to do things more effectively, for instance, by finding good people, good technologies, and/or good designs. Those with more character are better able to wrestle with their challenges and demands, and those with more wisdom can maintain their equanimity by going to the higher level and looking down on themselves and their challenges to properly prioritize, realistically design, and make sensible choices. A. Don't get frustrated. If nothing bad is happening to you now, wait a bit, and it will. That is just reality. My approach to life is that it is what it is, and the important thing is for me to figure out what to do about it and not spend time moaning about how I wish it were different. Winston Churchill hit the nail on the head when he said, "Success consists of going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm." You will come to enjoy this process of careening between success and failure because it will determine your trajectory. It makes no sense to get frustrated when there's so much that you can do and when life offers so many things to savor. Your path through any problem is outlined in these principles, and in others you'll discover yourself. There's nothing you can't accomplish if you think creatively and have the character to do the difficult things. Principle 14.3. Use checklists. When people are assigned tasks, it is generally desirable to have them captured on checklists. Crossing items off a checklist will serve as both a task reminder and a confirmation of what has been done. A. Don't confuse checklists with personal responsibility. People should be expected to do their whole job well, not just the tasks on their checklists. Principle 14.4. Allow time for rest and renovation. If you just keep doing, you will burn out and grind to a halt. Build downtime into your schedule, just as you would make time for all the other stuff that needs to get done. Principle 14.5. Ring the bell. When you and your team have successfully pushed through to achieve your goals, celebrate. Chapter 15. Use tools and protocols to shape how work is done. Words alone aren't enough. That's something I learned from watching people struggle to get themselves to do things that are in their best interests. After I shared these principles with the people at Bridgewater and refined them, nearly everyone saw the connection between the principles and our excellent results and wanted to operate in accordance with them. But there's a big difference between wanting to do something and actually being able to do it. Assuming people will do what they intellectually want to do is like assuming that people will lose weight simply because they understand why it's beneficial for them to do it. It won't happen until the proper habits are developed. In organizations, that happens with the help of tools and protocols. Take a minute to think about how this applies to your listening to this audiobook or listening to audiobooks in general. How often have you heard an audiobook describing some behavioral change you've wanted to make but then failed to? How much behavioral change do you think will result from this audiobook if you don't have the tools and protocols to help you? My guess is hardly any. Just as you can't learn many things by listening to an audiobook, how to ride a bike, speak a language, etc., it's nearly impossible to change a behavior without practicing it. That is why I plan to make the tools that I describe in the appendix publicly available. Principle 15.1. Having systemized principles embedded in tools is especially valuable for an idea meritocracy. That is because an idea meritocracy needs to operate in accordance with agreed-upon principles and to be evidence-based and fair instead of following the more autocratic and arbitrary decisions of the CEO and his or her lieutenants. Rather than be above the principles, the people responsible for the running of the organization must be evaluated, chosen, and if needed, replaced in an evidence-based way according to rules, just like everyone else in the organization. Their strengths and weaknesses, like everyone's, must be taken into consideration. Collecting objective data about all people is essential for this, and you need good tools to convert data into decisions in agreed-upon ways. Moreover, the tools allow the people and the system to work together in a symbiotic way to improve each other. A. To produce real behavioral change, understand that there must be internalized or habituated learning. Thankfully, technology has made internalized learning much easier today than it was when books were the primary way of conveying knowledge. Don't get me wrong, the book was a powerful invention. Gutenberg's printing press allowed easy dissemination of knowledge that helped people build on each other's learnings. But experiential learning is so much more powerful. Now that technology makes it so easy to create experiential virtual learning, I believe that we are on the brink of another step change improvement in the quality of learning that will be as great as or even greater than Gutenberg's. We have been trying to create internalized learning at Bridgewater for a long time, so how we do it has evolved a lot. Since we tape virtually all our meetings, we have been able to create virtual learning case studies that allow everyone to participate without actually being in the room. People see the meeting transpire as though they were in it, and then the case study pauses and asks them for their own thinking on the matter at hand. In some cases, they input their reactions in real time as they watch. Their thinking is recorded and compared with others using expert systems that help us all understand more about how we think. With this information, we can better tailor their learning and their job assignments to their thinking styles. That is just one example of a number of tools and protocols we have developed to help our people learn and operate by our principles. B. Use tools to collect data and process it into conclusions and actions. Imagine that virtually everything important going on in your company can be captured as data, and that you can build algorithms to instruct the computer as you would instruct a person, to analyze that data and use it in the way you agreed it should be used. In that way, you and the computer on your behalf could look at each person and all the people together and provide tailored guidance, just like your GPS provides you guidance by knowing all the traffic patterns and routes. You don't have to make it mandatory to follow that guidance, though you can. Generally speaking, the system operates like a coach, and the coach can learn about its team. Data is collected about what people do so that if they make more insightful moves or less insightful moves, learning will occur and be used to create improvements. Because the thinking behind the algorithms is available to everyone, anyone can assess the quality of the logic and its fairness and have a hand in shaping it. C. Foster an environment of confidence and fairness by having clearly stated principles that are implemented in tools and protocols so that the conclusions reached can be assessed by tracking the logic and data behind them. In all organizations, it's always the case that some of the people judged to be ineffective will argue that those judgments are wrong. When that happens, a data and rules-based system with clearly laid out criteria allows less room for such arguments and greater belief that the system is fair. Though the system won't be perfect, it is much less arbitrary and can much more easily be examined for bias than the much less specified and much less open decision-making of individuals with authority. My ideal is to have a process in which everyone contributes criteria for good decision-making and those criteria are assessed and selected by appropriately assigned believable people. If people maintain the right balance of open-mindedness and assertiveness so they understand where they are and aren't believable to make decisions, having these open discussions on the criteria for assessing and managing people can be very powerful in building and reinforcing the idea of meritocracy. We have early-stage tools that achieve these things, and we are striving to refine them so that our people management system operates as effectively as our investment management system. Even with its imperfections, our evidence-based approach to learning about people, guiding them, and sorting them is much fairer and more effective than the arbitrary and subjective management systems that most organizations still rely on. I believe that the forces of evolution will push most organizations towards systems that combine human and computer intelligence to program principles into algorithms that substantially improve decision-making. In the appendix, I have provided detailed descriptions of a number of the tools and protocols that support this idea meritocratic approach and reinforce the behaviors that people need to operate consistently with it. They are designed to help us achieve our goals of 1. Learning what people are like, 2. Sharing what people are like, 3. Providing personalized training and development, 4. Offering guidance and oversight in specific situations, and 5. Helping managers sort people into the right roles or out of the company based on what they are like and what is required. You don't need to use these same tools and protocols for your own idea meritocracy, but you should have ways of producing the internalized learning that it will require. While ours have evolved a lot, yours don't have to be as fancy or automated. For example, providing a form or a template to help guide people through the steps required for them to manage their work or carry out a process will yield better results than expecting them to just remember or figure it out on their own. How you decide to use tools and protocols is up to you. The main point I want to make here is that they're important. Chapter 16. And for heaven's sake, don't overlook governance. All that I've said thus far will be useless if you don't have good governance. Governance is the oversight system that removes the people and the processes if they aren't working well. It is the process that checks and balances power to assure that the principles and interests of the community as a whole are always placed above the interests and power of any individual or faction. Because power will rule, power must be put in the hands of capable people in key roles who have the right values, do their jobs well, and will check and balance the power of others. I didn't realize the importance of this sort of governance until after I transitioned out of the CEO role, because I was an entrepreneur and company builder, as well as an investment manager, who largely did what I thought was best. While I needed and developed double checks on myself, I created a management committee that I put above me so that I had to report to it. I always had the power of my equity to change things, though I never used it. Some might say that I was a benevolent despot, because while I had all the power, the complete voting rights, I exercised my power in an idea meritocratic way, recognizing that the good of the whole was best for us all, and that I needed to be double-checked. I certainly did not create the sort of governance system appropriate for Bridgewater, given its scale. For example, Bridgewater didn't have a board of directors overseeing the CEOs. There were no internal regulations, no judicial system for people to appeal to, and no enforcement system, because we didn't need them. I, with the help of others, simply created the rules and enforced them, though everyone had the right to appeal and overturn my and others' judgments. Our principles were the equivalent of what the Articles of Confederation had been to the United States in its first years, and our policies were like our laws, but I never created a formal way of operating such as a constitution or a justice system to enforce them and resolve disputes. As a result, when I stepped out and passed the power to others, confusions about decision rights arose. After conferring with some of the world's greatest experts on governance, we put a new system in place based on these principles. Still, I want to make clear that I don't consider myself an expert on governance and can't vouch for these next principles as much as I can vouch for the previous ones because they are still new. Principle 16.1. To be successful, all organizations must have checks and balances. By checks, I mean people who check on other people to make sure they're performing well, and by balances, I mean balances of power. Even the most benevolent leaders are prone to becoming more autocratic, if for no other reason than because managing a lot of people and having limited time to do it requires them to make numerous difficult choices quickly, and they sometimes lose patience with arguments and issue commands instead. And most leaders are not so benevolent that they can be trusted to put the organization's interests ahead of their own. A. Even in an idea meritocracy, merit cannot be the only determining factor in assigning responsibility and authority. Appropriate vested interests also need to be taken into consideration. For example, the owners of a company might have vested interests that they are perfectly entitled to that might be at odds with the vested interests of the people in the company who, based on the idea of meritocracy, are most believable. That should not lead the owners to simply turn over the keys to those leaders. That conflict has to be worked out. Since the purpose of the idea of meritocracy is to produce the best results, and the owners have the rights and powers to assess that, of course, they will make the determination, though I recommend they choose wisely. B. Make sure that no one is more powerful than the system, or so important that they are irreplaceable. For an idea meritocracy, it is especially important that its governance system is more powerful than any individual, and that it directs and constrains its leaders, rather than the other way around. The Chinese leader Wang Shishan drew my attention to what happened in ancient Rome when Julius Caesar revolted against the government, defeated his fellow general Pompey, seized control of the republic from the Senate, and named himself emperor for life. Even after he was assassinated and governance by the Senate was restored, Rome would never again be what it was. The era of civil strife that followed was more damaging than any foreign war. C. Beware of fiefdoms. While it's great for teams and departments to feel a strong bond of shared purpose, loyalty to a boss or department head cannot be allowed to conflict with loyalty to the organization as a whole. Fiefdoms are counterproductive and contrary to the values of an idea meritocracy. D. Make clear that the organization's structure and rules are designed to ensure that its checks and balances system functions well. Every organization has its own way of doing this. Bridgewater currently has about 1,500 people, and the principles the company follows are universal. I believe that all organizations need some version of this basic structure. There are 1 to 3 chairmen working with 7 to 15 board members supported by staff, whose purpose is primarily to assess whether 1. The people running the company are capable, 2. The company is operating in accordance with its agreed-upon principles and rules. The board has the power to select and replace the CEOs, but doesn't engage in the micromanagement of the firm nor the people running it, though in the event of an emergency, they can drop into a more active role. They can also help the CEOs to the extent they want it. While Bridgewater's idea meritocracy is ideally all-inclusive, there need to be various circles of authority, trust and access to information, and decision-making authority. E. Make sure reporting lines are clear. While this is important throughout the organization, it is especially important that the reporting lines of the board, those doing the oversight, are independent of the reporting lines of the CEOs, those doing the management, though there should be cooperation between them. F. Make sure decision rights are clear. Make sure it's clear how much weight each person's vote has, so that if a decision must be made when there is still disagreement, there is no doubt how to resolve it. G. Make sure that the people doing the assessing, 1. Have the time to be fully informed about how the person they are checking on is doing, 2. Have the ability to make the assessments, and 3. Are not in a conflict of interest that stands in the way of carrying out oversight effectively. In order to assess well, one has to gain a threshold level of understanding, and that takes time. Some people have the ability and the courage to hold people accountable, while most don't. Having such ability and courage is essential, and the person doing the assessing must not have conflicts of interest, such as being in a subordinate position to the person they are intended to check on, that stand in the way of holding them accountable, including recommending that they be fired. H. Recognize that decision makers must have access to the information necessary to make decisions and must be trustworthy enough to handle that information safely. That doesn't mean that all people must have access and be trustworthy. It is possible to have subcommittees who have access to sensitive information and make recommendations to the board that are substantiated with enough information to make good judgments, but without disclosing the highly sensitive particulars. Principle 16.2. Remember that in an idea meritocracy, a single CEO is not as good as a great group of leaders. Dependence on one person produces too much key man risk, limits the range of expertise because nobody is good at everything, and fails to establish adequate checks and balances. It also creates a burden because there's generally too much to do. That's why we have a co-CEO model at Bridgewater that is essentially a partnership of two or three people who lead the firm. At Bridgewater, the CEOs are overseen by a board, largely via the executive chairman or chairmen. In our idea meritocracy, the CEOs are also held accountable by the employees of the company, even though these employees are subordinate to the CEOs. The challenge of having two or three people is for them to dance well together. If they can't do that and coordinate well with the chairmen, they have to notify the executive chairman or chairmen so changes can be made. For the same reason we have more than one CEO overseeing management of the company, we have more than one chief investment officer. There are currently three. Principle 16.3. No governance system of principles, rules, and checks and balances can substitute for a great partnership. All these principles, rules, and checks and balances won't be worth much if you don't have capable people in positions of power who instinctually want to operate for the good of the community based on the agreed-upon principles. A company's leaders must have wisdom, competence, and the ability to have close, cooperative, and effective working relationships characterized by both thoughtful disagreement and commitment to following through with whatever the idea meritocratic process decides.
Work principles, putting it all together. We work with others to get three things. One, leverage to accomplish our chosen missions in bigger and better ways than we could achieve alone. Two, quality relationships that make for a great community. And three, money that allows us to buy what we need and want for ourselves and for others. Since the relative importance of these varies by person, it's up to you to determine the quantities and mix you want. The most important thing is to realize that they are mutually supportive. If you want to accomplish your mission, you will be better off having quality relationships with people committed to that mission and financial resources to put behind it. Similarly, if you want to have a great work community, you will need a shared mission and financial resources to support you. And if you want to make the most money possible, you will need clear goals and tight relationships to achieve them. In my life, I've been lucky to have much more of all three of these than I ever could have imagined. I've tried to convey the approach that worked well for me. In other words, an idea meritocracy in which meaningful work and meaningful relationships are the goals, and radical truth and radical transparencies are the way for achieving them. I tried to do that so that you could decide if any of it is of use to you. Recognizing that I gave you a pile of principles that could be confusing, I want to make sure that the headline that I'm trying to get across comes through. It is that of all approaches to decision-making, an idea meritocracy is the best. It's almost too obvious to warrant saying, but I'll say it anyway. Knowing what you can and cannot expect from each person, and knowing what to do to make sure that the best ideas win out, are the best ways to make decisions. Idea meritocratic decision-making is better than traditional autocratic or democratic decision-making in almost all cases. That's not just theory. While there's no such thing as utopia, just like there's no such thing as perfect, there is great. And there isn't much doubt that the results of this idea meritocratic approach have been pretty great for Bridgewater for more than 40 years. Because this approach can work equally well in most organizations, I wanted to lay it out clearly and in detail. While you needn't follow this approach exactly as I've done it, the big question is, do you want to work in an idea meritocracy? If so, what is the best way for you to do that? An idea meritocracy requires people to do three things. First, put their honest thoughts on the table for everyone to see. Second, have thoughtful disagreements where there are quality backs and forths in which people evolve their thinking to come up with the best collective answers possible. And third, abide by idea meritocratic ways of getting past their disagreements, such as believability-weighted decision-making. While an idea meritocracy doesn't have to operate exactly in any particular way, it does, by and large, have to follow those three steps. Don't worry about remembering all the particular principles that I gave you in this book. Just go after having an idea meritocracy and figure out what works for you by encountering your trade-offs and coming up with your principles for handling them. You might want to refer to the principles that are relevant that I encountered when I encountered those same trade-offs, but you decide for yourself what you want. In my case, I wanted meaningful work and meaningful relationships, and I believe that being radically truthful and radically transparent were required to get those. Then I went after them, and I encountered problems that forced me to make my choices. By writing down how I made these choices, I was able to flesh out my principles, which led me to shape Bridgewater's idea meritocracy with the people I worked with so that it would work well for us. As you set out on your own and encounter your own impediments, you might want to refer back to these principles because chances are that I've encountered many of the same impediments, did my wrestling with how to handle them, and laid out my thinking in the principles. And then write down your own. Of course, people's abilities to influence how their group works varies, and I don't know your circumstances. But I do know that if you want to work in an idea meritocratic way, you can find your own way of doing that. Maybe it will be by helping to shape your organization from the top. Maybe it will be by choosing the right organization for you. And maybe it will be by simply dealing with the people you work with in an idea meritocratic way. No matter what your position is, you can always practice being open-minded and assertive at the same time, and thinking about your and others' believabilities when deciding what to do. Above all else, my wishes for you are, one, you make your work and your passion one and the same. Two, you can struggle well with others on your common mission to produce the previously mentioned rewards. Three, you can savor both your struggles and your rewards. And four, you will evolve quickly and contribute to evolution in a significant way. Conclusion. It's up to you to decide what you want to get out of life and what you want to give. As I said from the outset, my goal is to pass along the principles that work well for me, and what you do with them is up to you. I, of course, hope that they will help you visualize your own audacious goals, navigate through your painful mistakes, have quality reflections, and come up with good principles of your own that you will systematically follow to produce outcomes that vastly exceed your expectations. I hope they will help you do these things both individually and when working with others. And since your journey and evolution will certainly be a struggle, I hope these principles will help you struggle and evolve well. Perhaps they will even inspire you and others to put your principles in writing and collectively figure out what's best in an idea meritocratic way. If I could tilt the world even one degree more in that direction, that would thrill me. Along these lines, there's more to come. Because I know that having tools and protocols is necessary to helping people convert what they want to do into actually doing it, I will soon be making the ones we've created available to you. I feel I've now done the best I can to pass along my life and work principles. Of course, we aren't done with our struggles until we die. Since my latest struggle has been to pass along whatever I have that has been of value, I feel a certain sense of relief to have gotten these principles out to you, and a sense of contentment as I end this book and turn my attention to passing along my economic and investment principles.
Appendix. Tools and Protocols for Bridgewater's Idea Meritocracy. What follows is a quick overview of many of the tools and processes currently in use at Bridgewater. It's my intention to soon share many of these with the wider world in a Principles app so you can try them out for yourself. Coach. Because there are too many principles for anyone to keep top of mind enough to apply appropriately to whatever situation they face, and because it's easier to ask for advice than to seek it out in a book, I created Coach. Coach's platform is populated with a library of common situations or ones of those. For example, disagreeing with an assessment someone made, someone lied or did something unethical, etc., which are linked to the relevant principles to help people handle them. As people use Coach, they give feedback on the quality of advice it provides, essentially coaching the coach so that it can deliver better and better advice. Over time, Coach has become increasingly effective in much the same way Siri has. Dot Collector. The Dot Collector is an app used in meetings that allows people to express their thoughts and see others' thoughts in real time, and then helps them collectively reach an idea meritocratic decision. It surfaces people's thinking, analyzes it, and uses the information to help people make real-time decisions better in a few ways. Specifically, participants continuously record their assessments of each other by giving them dots, positive or negative, on any number of several dozen attributes. These dots are laid out in a grid that updates dynamically so that everyone in the conversation can see one another's thinking as the meeting progresses. Doing this helps people shift their perspectives from being stuck in their own heads with their own opinions to looking down on everyone's views. Seeing things through everyone's eyes naturally causes most people to adopt the higher level view in which they recognize that their own perspective is just one of many, so they ask themselves which criteria are best for deciding how to resolve the issue at hand. In this way, it promotes open-minded, idea meritocratic, collective decision-making. It helps people make decisions by providing advice in the same way a GPS does, by taking data on what everyone in the room is like. The app is able to give people individualized coaching, which is especially important when their own opinions are unlikely to be right. We have found that helping people through such times can be invaluable. The Dot Collector highlights what we call nubby questions, cases where the pattern of answers and attributes of people on different sides of an issue suggest that there's an important disagreement to be resolved. For example, it will alert you automatically if you disagree with the believability-weighted majority on a given issue and give you guidance on the appropriate steps to take to resolve that disagreement in an evidence-based way. It enables believability-weighted voting. The Dot Collector provides both a polling interface where people can vote yes or no or provide a numerical rating, and a back-end system of believability weighting, which allows us to look at vote results on both equal-weighted and believability-weighted bases, not as just simple majorities, but also based on which way the people whose views have the most merit voted. While this may sound complicated, it's simply a way of helping people keep track of believability without having to remember who is more believable at what. Baseball cards. In addition to collecting dots about people in meetings, we collect data on our people in numerous other ways, reviews, tests, the choices people make, etc. All these dots are analyzed via computerized algorithms based on stress-tested logic in order to create pointillist pictures of what people are like. That logic is typically shared with and vetted by the people in the company to help its objectivity and believability. We then capture these pictures in baseball cards, which are a simple way of presenting a person's strengths and weaknesses and the evidence behind them, in much the same way as a baseball card does for a professional baseball player. I found that we needed to have these and refer to them regularly because without them, people tended to interact with each other without any regard to who was good or bad at what. For example, baseball cards are useful in meetings where they allow people to assess the qualities of whoever is expressing a point of view to determine the merit of that opinion. As a supplement to baseball cards, we developed another tool called the People Profile, which takes all the data from baseball cards, which have grown complex over time, to provide a simple text-based summary of what each person is like. Over time, this is meant to provide employees with a systemized synthesis that captures Bridgewater's best thinking about what someone is like. We work with the people being assessed to compare these pictures with the assessed person's own perceptions. In this way of seeking alignment between the process and the person's self-perception, both the processes and the confidences in the perceptions are improved. In order to match people to jobs, I developed the Combinator, which takes the data from the baseball cards and allows one to look at people based on their key attributes and compare them to one another. If you're looking for a certain type of person to fill a role, you can enter a few names of people who fit the image, and the Combinator will call up the precise data on what those people are like, synthesize the key qualities that make them that way, and then search the database to help you find other similar people. The Combinator can also be used to generate job specifications based on the type of person you are looking for that you can apply both inside and outside the company. Issue log. The issue log is our primary tool for recording our mistakes and learning from them. We use it to bring all problems to the surface so we can put them in the hands of problem solvers to make systematic improvements. It acts like a water filter that catches garbage. Anything that goes wrong must be issue logged, with the severity of the issue and who is responsible for it specified, so that it's easy to sort through most problems. Issue logs also provide paths for diagnosing problems and the information pertaining to them. In that way, they also provide effective metrics of performance, as they allow you to measure the numbers and types of problems coming up, and identify the people who are contributing to them and fixing them. The issue log is a good example of a tool that changed habits and perceptions. The common challenge people had at first was openly pointing out mistakes because some people instinctively viewed pointing out mistakes as hurtful to the people who made them. Once they got used to doing this, they realized the benefit of it, and they got in the good habit of doing it. Pain button. I believe pain plus reflection equals progress. In other words, pain is an important signal that there is something to be learned, and if you reflect on your pain well, you will almost always learn something important. That prompted me to create the pain button. The moment someone experiences pain is the best time for them to record what the pain is like, but it's a bad time to reflect because it's hard to keep a clear head. So the app is designed to let people record the emotions they are feeling, anger, disappointment, frustration, etc., as they feel them, and then come back at a later time to reflect on them using guided reflection questions. The tool prompts the people who experience the pain to specify what they will do to deal with that situation, so that the pain is mitigated in the future. For example, have a quality conversation with the person who is causing the pain, etc. There is a part of the app that shows the frequency of the pain and the causes of the pain, and whether the actions were followed through and productive. In that way, one receives a sort of biofeedback connection among the pain that occurred, the diagnosis of it, the plan for improvement so that the problems are reduced or eliminated, the following through on these plans, and the results produced. The tool creates a template for looping toward improvement that everyone can see. It allows you to share your entries with others or keep them to yourself. Some people have described the pain button as like having a psychologist in your pocket, although better, as it's always available and a hell of a lot cheaper. Dispute Resolver. Disputes need clear paths toward resolution. That is especially so in an idea meritocracy where people are expected to disagree and create paths for resolving disagreements. The Dispute Resolver provides paths for resolving disagreements in an idea meritocratic way. It asks a series of questions used to guide the people through the resolution process. One of its features is that it locates believable people who can help determine whether a disagreement is worth taking up at a higher level. The app also makes clear to everyone that if they have a different point of view from others, it's up to them to express it and work to get in sync, instead of privately holding on to the view and not putting it on the table. Whether you have a tool like the Dispute Resolver or not, you must have a clear and fair system to resolve disputes in order to ensure there is a real idea meritocracy. Otherwise, the person with greater power could pull rank on the person with lesser power. We also have a number of tools that help us complete and oversee our day-to-day work and stay in sync regarding how things are going. Daily Update Tool. For years, I have asked each person who reports to me to take about 10 to 15 minutes to write a brief email of what they did that day the issues pertaining to them, and their reflections. By reading these updates and triangulating them, in other words, seeing different people's takes on what they're doing, I can gauge how they are working together, what their moods are, and which threads I should pull. Over the last few years, I've developed this into a software application that pulls these updates into a dashboard, which makes them much easier to track, record metrics, and respond to than dealing with dozens of separate email threads. It also allows people to easily provide helpful data, like their morale, how heavy their workload is, issues they want to escalate, on a daily basis. I and those I work with find